right, if you would, get your Bibles out. If you have the little chart of the kings and the prophets, they're in the divided kingdom. If you have that with you, then get it out. You're going to do a little marking on it tonight. If you don't have it, then for $5. Now raise your hand as Bob comes around, and there are some small ones, and then there are some regular size ones. Pardon? Yeah, senior citizens. Well, actually, somebody wanted some bigger than that. So, if you need one, then raise your hand as he comes by, and he might need somebody to help him. I don't know, but anyway. The small one is one that you can put in your Bible, and you know, if we need some additional ones, then we'll make some. We are learning to enjoy studying our Bibles. And if you don't understand it, and so we're in the process of having what I've called the big picture. And it's as those of you, as you're learning about me, I have a hard time staying on the big picture. I can see it for a little while, and then I have a tendency to get down into more minute detail. And actually, tonight, we're going to get into a little bit of detail, because occasionally I feel like we need to drop down in some detail to give you an illustration of why it's so valuable that you have this whole picture. You need the picture to enable you to appreciate each component part of that big picture. We started out talking about three promises that God gave to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12 that comprise a three-point outline of the entire Bible. God told Abraham that he was going to make of his descendants a great nation of people, that he was going to give that nation a land, and that through his seed all nations of the earth would be blessed. We saw the fulfillment of that first promise, that he was going to make him a great nation, from Genesis 12 to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7. And that included the personalities of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And then we come to Exodus chapter 1, verse 7, and they are and have become a great nation of people. And from that point on, beginning in Exodus chapter 1 through the end of the book of Joshua, is the story of God giving that people, the Hebrews, the Jews, the children of Israel, the Israelites, giving them a land, the land of Canaan. And so Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, and Joshua is the story of that people gaining a land. And then there's only one promise that remains, and that is that through your seed, he told Abraham, all nations of the earth would be blessed. And that seed, Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, was Jesus Christ. And so through the physical lineage of Abraham, Jesus Christ came. And so that's the three-point outline of the whole Bible. So now you can tell the story of the Bible, if you can just remember those three. Now, there are a few details to fit in, meanwhile, but you have something that stretches from one end to the other that gives you the picture of what the Bible is and the story of the Bible. We can tell the story of the Bible from Genesis to early into the divided kingdom, which would be in Kings. We can tell that story with just a sequence of biographies. You can certainly begin with Adam and Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph. And then after Joseph is who? Moses, right? And then Joshua. And then after Joshua, you have a time period. You can memorize, if you'd like to, the prophets, but it's a period of the prophets. And then we get into the period of the kings. And in the period of the kings, we have two divisions, and that would be the United Kingdom and the Divided Kingdom. And so once we get into, basically, we can get at least most of it into the divided kingdom through just one story of a person's life after another, after another, after another, after another. We get to the period of the judges, and we'll say, well, we know some of those. You know, we know something about Deborah. We know something about Samson. We know something about Gideon. We know some of those stories. We don't necessarily know a lot about Tola or Jer or Jephthah or, you know, some of the others. Some people do, by the way. And you certainly could memorize all of them if you would like. But that period encompasses a relatively brief period in Israel's history. And then the people in the last days of the judges, during Samuel being the last judge, they said, "We want a king." And so God gave them a king. And for 120 years, all the kingdom was united under three kings: Saul, and then when he died, David, and then when he died, Solomon. And then after Solomon, his son, Rehoboam, divided the kingdom. The kingdom split at that point. And at that point, they come to be known as Israel and Judah. Israel will be the 10 northern tribes. Judah will be the 2 southern tribes. The 10 northern tribes, will be under the kingship of Jeroboam, and the 2 southern tribes will be under the kingship of Rehoboam, Solomon's son. The capital city of the 10 northern tribes, Israel, will be Samaria. The capital city of the 2 southern tribes, Judah, will be Jerusalem. So these are just some facts that when you put these together, you understand the story more. Israel will last just over 200 years, about 205 years from the time that the kingdom is divided. It will have 19 kings. There won't be a single good king in the whole mess. They will come to an end when the Assyrian Empire comes and takes them away captive. And we're going to come back and we're going to pick up here tonight, but let me just go ahead and run it ahead just to keep skipping across the broad picture here. When they're carried away by the Assyrians as captives, they won't ever come back. And so the 10 northern tribes, Israel, will no longer exist. About 135 years later, once a world empire has changed, the Assyrians will fall, the Babylonians will come into power. Then the Babylonians will come and they will take the 2 southern tribes, Judah, away captive. They'll come 3 times. They'll take captives away 3 times. They won't stay gone forever. They'll come back after 70 years. Another world empire will have risen by that time, the Medes and the Persians. And as the Old Testament comes to a close, we find under the Medes and the Persians, then the Jews are coming back to their homeland. And just like they went in 3 different deportations, there will be 3 returns. And we'll look at those in Ezra and Nehemiah. And by the time, if you started reading your Old Testament and you started in Genesis, by the time you got to the end of Nehemiah, you would have read the Old Testament. That's the story. The story ends at the end of Nehemiah. Everything else, all the prophets, comes back and lays over what you just read. And so your history will come to an end in Nehemiah. And then there will be a period of 400 years when the Bible falls silent. It's called the intertestament period, between the Old and the New Covenant, the Old and the New Testament. By the time the New Testament begins, we have yet another world power, and that world power is Rome. Meanwhile, during that 400-year period of time, there will be a world empire that came to power and went out of power while the Bible was silent, and that was the Greek Empire. Last time we went to Daniel chapter 2 and we saw Daniel's interpretation of King Nebuchadnezzar's dream of that 90-foot high statue, and he said, "King, you are that head of gold. There will be another kingdom inferior to you after you that's represented by the silver. There'll be a third kingdom that will come after that that's yet inferior to that one that will be represented by the bronze. And then there'll be a fourth kingdom that will come. And it's going to be a really strong kingdom, at least in part. as you get down to the legs, it's of iron, and you get down to the feet and the toes, and they're iron mixed with clay. And like oil and water, they don't mix very well. And so he says the kingdom was partly strong, it was partly weak. And during the days of these kings, the God of heaven is going to set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed. It'll never be left to another people. And we noted last time that that, of course, is the church that began in Acts chapter 2. God's kingdom, that is an eternal kingdom. And so that's just running across, and we'll run across in different ways, hopefully several more times. And as you hear this story over and over again, then something new will stick each time, and you'll remember more and more of it. And I recommend to you that you make some notes. I would like for you to, can we put up our chart? Have we got it yet? I want you to write four dates down on that chart. This thing got a pointer? Yeah. I want you to write them right up there. You don't have much room, but I want you to write them right there. So you're going to have to write kind of small. I told you last time I'm not big on dates, and I'm not. And I don't care if you remember these dates or not, because I don't want you to give me a test on them, you know, a year from now when I haven't looked it over. But I want you to have them. And I'm going to show you what we're going to do with them in just a few minutes. The first date that I want you to write down is 7, and these are B.C. dates, before Christ or before B.C.E., if you prefer. The first date I want you to write down is 732. 732. That'll be B.C. And we'll come back and we'll fill in beside them. Under that, write 722. Bless you. And under that, write 612. And one last one, 539. Now, beside the first date, I want you to write, that would be 732, I want you to write Damascus Falls. D-A-M-A-S-C-U-S. Damascus Falls. Under 7, beside 722, I want you to write Samaria Falls. 722. Beside 612, I want you to write Nineveh Falls. N-I-N-E-V-E-H. Nineveh Falls. And then beside 539, I want you to write Babylon Falls. And then what I want you to do, if we were all in a class, and the class was not so large, I would have brought highlighters, and I would pass them out to you, and I would say, now, children, you're going to color, and you're going to fill in here. But I want you to do that when you get home. And so you have an assignment for next time. What I want you to do when you get home is I want you to locate these dates on this timeline. And I want you to remember something before you mess it up, okay? 732, I'm going to have to get down here so I can see this thing, okay? 732, where am I? Right here. 732 is not on this side of 730. It's on this side. It comes before 7. You're counting down. Okay? You're not counting up. So you're going to make a mark right about right there. 732. And just take a pen or pencil and make yourself a mark right there. And then 722 is going to be right about here. You see right there? That's where your line is going to come, right down at the end of that line right there where it says the kingdom ends. See that? And then, what's your next date? 612? It's going to be right here on the left side of 610. And then the next one was what, 539? It's going to be on the right side of 540. And I want you to put you a little dot there. And then, when you've got your dot in the right place, I want you to draw a line, get a straight edge, make it look nice, okay? And draw it straight down. And you're not going to draw one at 522, but you're going to have it noted. But at 532, you're going to draw a line straight down. That'd be this one right here. And then at 612, you're going to draw another line. And you'll notice, again, you don't have two kingdoms down here. One kingdom up here, Israel, it's gone. And so when you get down here, you only have Judah. Okay? You understand why it's only half size down here? And then you've got some extra stuff right here that you can read if you'd like. And then when you draw your line right here, then I want you to write over that Assyria. Now, it's really hard historically. I mean, historians assign a date for the rise of an empire and the fall of an empire. And it's not real precise, okay? But historians get together and they're pretty close. They're pretty close with one another. We'll talk about why that date right there was chosen as the beginning of Assyria as a world empire. And essentially, it's because when Assyria began to spread out and become take over other nations, and when a major nation fell at that point right there, then history will say, okay, Assyria became a world power. And Assyria will remain a world power until the capital city falls, right here. And that's what's going to happen right there. You've got on your map. 612, what happened? Nineveh fell. Nineveh is the capital city of Assyria. So when it falls, you got a new sheriff in town here. And so the new sheriff is going to be Babylonia. Now you'll notice these are strong world empires, but they don't last so long. The United States of America has been a world empire for over 200 years. That's pretty long. Some of these didn't last so long. Now, this doesn't mean that Babylon was not strong over here a few years before this. But it was not recognized as the world empire until this point right here, whenever Nineveh will fall. And it will fall to Babylonia. And then Babylon will fall to the Medes and the Persians. And so you've got 539, Babylon falls. And this will go on into the intertestament period. And by the way, I have a good friend that we studied this together, and he said, would you like a chart of the intertestament period like this? And I said, yeah, I would. So he made me one that stretches about from here to the baptistry, but I don't remember if I have a small one of it or not. But we probably won't get quite into as much detail there unless you particularly want it, and then I'll come up with something for you. But again, if you'll draw these lines and color these with highlighters, don't color them with something that covers up the words, okay? Because you lose the value of it. So if you'll color this in with a highlighter, then when you look at this, you'll look at Isaiah up here, and you'll be able to know that at the very early beginning of Isaiah's prophecy, he might be talking about Assyria becoming a world empire, or he might be talking about Israel coming to an end. And guess what? He's going to be talking about both those things. And Isaiah prophesied for a long time. Before Isaiah gets through here, he's going to be prophesying that Babylonia is going to come on the scene. And not only that, he's going to prophesy that Babylonia is going to go off the scene. But you can have a historical context. And I want you to have a historical context for the prophets, because there are lots of reasons. For one, you'll enjoy studying it. The other is, you won't be so gullible when people come up and tell you that the bear that Daniel talked about is Russia in the 20th century. You'll have a historical context to put that in, and you'll be able to go back and say, wait a minute. Whenever he talked about that leopard, he said that that leopard was Alexander. He called him. He called him by name. And so it looks to me like that that bear and that leopard were fighting one another, and they met, and they had a big war over here in the Tigris-Euphrates area in that context, and you've got a context to talk intelligently about what Daniel was talking about and to understand it. And so I want you now, you know, Ezekiel, he ate some bad food. He had some strange visions, okay? I mean, he had some wheels within wheels and so forth, and it takes Elton to sort that out for us. But I'm not promising you that every single one of this apocalyptic literature that you're going to immediately know what it is. Some of these things you're going to have to give a little extra study to, and some of them we may have to wait and ask the Lord about. But you can make this chart as valuable as you would like. And as you study, there's two or three books that you can get, one or two books, history books that you can get, that you can go here, and at the bottom you can add, or particularly right here, you can add who the kings of, for instance, Assyria will be. Because you're going to run across their names in Kings and in Isaiah and Micah and some of these other prophets. You're going to run across their names. And when you run across a fellow by the name of Sennacherib, who is Sennacherib? Well, he was one of the Assyrian kings. And you get Sargon and Shalmaneser. And you come, the Bible has these names in it. And if you'll, you know, if you want to make your chart more valuable, then you can do a little historical research and write the names of these kings of these empires. And here you would come with Nebuchadnezzar, and then you have other ones that follow him. You'd have Cyrus and Darius right here when they started out, became a world power, the Medes and the Persians. I'm sorry. It does. That was my scribe that made a mistake. You're exactly right. It should be 539. I'm my scribe. Okay. Between the two of us, we did it. Okay. Anyway, you're right, and I appreciate the catch. It is 539, so it's at the wrong place there. It should be right. Right, where am I? Right here. Right here. Just the last part. Am I right? 539? Yeah, it should be right here. Okay, that line. All right, so good catch, and thanks. That's one. Another thing that I've done on one of my charts over a period of time is I have put the scriptural reference where you can go and find the story of Rehoboam. Now, you got to write small, okay? But and Abijah and Asa and Jehoshaphat and Ahab and Omri and Zimri and Elah, and you can look them up, and they're in order. They're in chronological order in Kings, and so you can go where the first time that you find, for instance, Ahab's name, and write that down, and then you can find where he died, and you can just make a little note of that right there. And you can have this chart becomes more and more valuable as you choose to do that. So that's a little of what you can do with the chart. If you have some additional questions, then talk to me about it, and I'll be glad to try to answer any questions that you might have. As you can see, occasionally I have made a mistake, but anyway. So keep that with you. We're going to refer to it for a few weeks here. We're going to go through some of these. I would encourage you and hope that you'll mark and highlight this and these dates here. I want to do a little bit of reading tonight. I've just been talking. I want us to do a little bit of Bible reading tonight. Go turn with me, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 16. 2 Kings 16. By the way, you probably know that Kings and Chronicles are parallel. And if you find it in Kings, you can probably find it in Chronicles. And so if you want to cross-reference your Bible when you find the story in Kings, then go over to Chronicles and find it, and you can cross-reference the two. It's kind of like Matthew and Mark. One of them will give you some details about an incident that another one doesn't, and so forth. So those two lay on top of one another, Kings and Chronicles do. Let's go back to, we're in 732 now, thereabouts. Look on your chart, see what's happening in 732. You've got a kingdom that is about to come to an end, right? In the 17th year of Pekah, son of Remaliah. Where's Pekah? You see him? Right here. So you already know when it says Pekah, what do you know? You only got one more king left, don't you? And the empire is going to come to an end. So in the 17th year of Pekah, so if it's 17th year, he's probably pretty close to the end. Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. Interesting thing about Kings and Chronicles. Unless you know this, you really get discouraged and try to keep these names sorted out. When he wants to tell you that a new king is coming to the throne of Judah, he will refer to the king of Israel and tell you, in the 17th year of so-and-so, the king of Israel, so-and-so came to the throne of Judah, and vice versa. When he wants to tell you that Israel has a new king, he will say, in the 4th year of so-and-so, king of Judah, so-and-so came to the throne, became the king of Israel. They always use the other one to date the one that you're about to see. And that's the way he started out right here. Ahaz was 20 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 16 years. So, if we're in Jerusalem, then Pekah's on the throne, Ahaz is on the throne. Okay? You got it? On your timeline? He did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. Now we're talking about Ahaz, the king of Judah. He walked in the ways of the king of Israel. What ways did the king of Israel walk in? They sinned the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, right? They had the two calf idols. They worshipped idols. And so whenever it says that they walked in the same path that Israel's king did, then you know they were idol. He was an idol worshiper. Unlike his father David, he did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God. He walked in the ways of the king of Israel and even sacrificed his son in the fire. Following the detestable ways of the nations, the Lord had driven out before the Israelites. He offered sacrifices and burnt incense at the high places, hilltops, and under every spreading tree. Then Rezin, king of Aram, and if you want to write beside there, Aram is another word for Syria. So he's talking about the king of Syria. In your mind, go to your map. Where's Syria? You remember? Syria is a northern neighbor of Israel. So he says, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem and Ahaz. So now you have a confederacy of Syria and Israel are coming to fight against Judah. But they could not overpower him. At that time, Rezin, king of Aram, recovered Elath, and the Edomites moved back in, and they live there to this day. Verse 7. Ahaz sent messengers to say to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, I am your servant. Here we are. We've got Ahaz is being attacked by Pekah, and we don't have Syria up there, but the king of Syria and Pekah have joined together, and they're going to fight against Judah and Ahaz. Ahaz is terrified. And so he calls to the king of Assyria. Big mistake. I am your servant and vassal. Come up and save me out of the hand of the king of Aram, the king of Israel, who are attacking me. Ahaz took silver and gold found in the temple of the Lord and the treasures of the royal palace and sent it as a gift to the king of Assyria. The king of Assyria complied by attacking Damascus and capturing it. He deported its inhabitants to Kir and put Rezin to death. Guess what fell? Right here. What city? Damascus, the capital city of Syria. That's where that happened, right here. Pekah's on the throne. Ahaz is on the throne. And at this time, when Assyria comes, he takes Syria, Damascus. And it is the fall of Damascus that historians mark as the Assyria beginning as a world empire. And it is Judah, Ahaz, who occasioned that by calling Assyria and giving them an excuse to come over. Then verse 10 says, King Ahaz went to Damascus. And by the way, here's a really interesting story. You can read it. He went to Damascus to meet Tiglath-Pileser. He had called him, and now he needed to go pay him. And so he went to Damascus to meet him, and he saw an altar, an idol altar there, and he was so enamored with it that when he came back, he gave orders to build one just like it in Judah. And you think, really? Are you serious? You mean to tell me that you've called this foreign nation over here, and now instead of depending on God, who has delivered you, even through your ignorance, and you're going to set this idol up? And it tells about it all the way down to the end of at least verse 18 in that chapter there. And 10 years later, 732 to 722, Assyria comes back. This time they got a different king. His name is Sennacherib. He comes back, and this time he doesn't have to take Damascus because he already owns Damascus. He comes down right here. And in the reign of Hoshea, he takes Israel captive, Samaria captive. And that story is in 2 Kings chapter 17. Let's begin reading in verse 1. In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, so 12 years have passed since this all started, king of Samaria, he reigned 9 years. He did evil in the eyes of the Lord, but not like the kings of Israel who preceded him. Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea, who had been Shalmaneser's vassal and had paid him tribute. But the king of Assyria discovered that Hoshea was a traitor, for he had sent envoys to So, the king of Egypt. Why did he do that? He thought that the king of Egypt would get him out from under this tax burden that he was with the Assyrians. And so he decided, I'm not going to pay taxes anymore. So here comes the Assyrian king. He says he no longer paid tribute to the king of Assyria as he had done year by year. Therefore, Shalmaneser seized him, put him in prison. The king of Assyria invaded the entire land, marched against Samaria, laid siege to it for 3 years. In the 9th year of Hoshea, the king of Assyria captured Samaria and deported the Israelites to Assyria. He settled them in Halath and Gozan, the Habor River, and the towns of the Medes. So, now the northern kingdom has been carried away captive. They don't exist anymore by the Assyrians. Now, do you think that Shalmaneser is going to be happy with that? That he's going to be satisfied? No, he decides, okay, you know, I'm over here, got my army going, let's keep going. And so he comes down through Judah. And if you go to the British Museum, there are the annals of Sennacherib. I mean, his actual annals, they're there. Now, I can't read them, you can't read them, but they got them translated. And it will say, Sennacherib will say, he will claim that he has captured 46 cities in Judah, which evidently he did. He came down to Jerusalem. He laid siege to Jerusalem. And in laying siege to Jerusalem, Hezekiah is now the king, right here. Whenever they fall, Hezekiah's the king. And Hezekiah is terrified because here this king has laid siege to Jerusalem. And so he calls out to God, and God sends the prophet Isaiah to him. And Isaiah will say to him, "Don't worry about this. There will not be one single arrow that will fall inside Jerusalem. Don't worry about it. Trust me." The next morning, when the Assyrian forces woke up, 185,000 of them didn't wake up. An angel of the Lord had passed through that night, and 185,000 corpses were in their tents. Sennacherib goes back home. And in just a very short period after that, his two sons assassinate him in the temple of his God. Now, it's really, there are lots of interesting history right here, and I know I'm almost out of time, but I think I've shared this with you one time before, but to show you how it historically fits in. When Sennacherib had laid siege to Jerusalem, and he sent his ambassador to Jerusalem to try to get them, he was fighting somewhere else at the time, he sent his ambassador, Nebuzaradan, to Jerusalem to say, "Hey, you need to give up. Who do you think you can trust in that you would resist my master?" He said, "Do you trust in Egypt?" He said, "Egypt is like a reed, that whenever you try to put a little bit of weight on it, it'll break and it'll pierce through your hand." They never have come through with what they told you they would do. Are you trusting in Egypt, really? And then he said, "Do you trust in your God?" He said, "Isn't that the same God that Hezekiah has removed his worship and replaced it with worship to high places and to other gods? And so why do you think your God would come and rescue you now? Besides that, what city has been able to resist me up to this time? And all of these 46 cities that I've already taken, they claim the same God that you claim. So don't let Hezekiah persuade you that you're going to be able to resist me." And so he said, "If you'll just give up, then you can stay here and you can eat your own produce and sit under your own tree and eat your own vine until we come, and then we'll take you to a place that's a really good place, a really pleasant place, but you'll be alive." And so he says, "Choose life and not death." Well, that's obviously pretty tempting, except Isaiah has come to him and he said, "God said, it's not going to happen." Interesting little scenario right here. Let me see where I want to go. And I'm keeping you here. But go to chapter 18. And go skip down. I wish we could pick up the story that I just got through telling you is in the first part of 18. Go down to verse 17 of chapter 18. "The king of Assyria sent his supreme commander, his chief officer, and his field commander with a large army from Lachish to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. They came up to Jerusalem and stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. And they called for the king, and Eliakim and Hilkiah, the palace administrator, and Shebna, the secretary, came. And the field commander said, 'Okay, here's a message to give to Hezekiah.'" Now, you can read the message. I want to point something out to you. Why in the world would it say that when this guy came and that he stopped at this particular place? They came up to Jerusalem and stopped at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. Well, let me tell you why. And this is a little piece of research that I've done that I'd like to share with you. In ancient times, the proposed location of a new city was based primarily on two important factors: ease of fortification and abundant water supply. The site of Jerusalem enjoyed natural impregnability. Its earliest inhabitants were willing to put up with the inconvenience of having to bring water from a natural spring located in the Kidron Valley known as Gihon Springs. Today, the spring is known to Christians as the Virgin's Fountain, to the Muslims as the Spring of the Stairway. Prior to the Israelite occupation of the land of Palestine, the Canaanites had dug a tunnel from within the city to a point from which containers could be lowered into the pool formed by Gihon Springs. Sometime after the capture of Jerusalem by the Israelites, a tunnel was dug in the hillside leading from Gihon Pool, which came to be known as the Upper Pool, to a reservoir called the Lower Pool in the southern end of the city. The problem was that the open-air channel ran outside the city walls for most of its course and could be easily dammed up in time of siege, meaning they had no water in Jerusalem. Later, a new conduit was dug, partially through Ophel Rock, but the other part was a ditch covered with flat stones. Since this was still outside the city walls, it could still be obstructed with little difficulty. Assyria conquered Syria in 732. Samaria in 722. Hezekiah was king of Judah. He rebelled against the king of Assyria, 2 Kings 18:7. Anticipating Assyria's reprisal, King Sennacherib, Hezekiah constructed a tunnel to bring water into the city, 2 Kings chapter 20, verse 20. It's recognized as one of the great engineering feats of antiquity. First, he built the Siloam Reservoir inside the city of Jerusalem, inside the city walls. Then he began with two crews of workmen. One began from Gihon Springs, which was down in the valley. The other from Siloam Pool, which was inside the city. The tunnel is 1,750 feet long, about a third of a mile. The average height of the tunnel is just under 6 feet. The total fall in elevation from the spring to the pool is 7 feet 2 inches. The width of the tunnel varies from 23 to 26 inches. So it's almost 6 feet tall, 23 to 26 inches. It has been estimated that 850 cubic yards of rock had to be removed, and the job took 6 to 7 months. The tunnel's existence was not known by the first century B.C. Its presence was rediscovered in 1838. And in 1880, an excavator slipped while he was walking the tunnel, and he fell into water. Upon arising, he noticed an inscription on a smooth portion of the wall, which has come to be known as the Siloam Inscription. And here's what it says, the part that they've been able to save. People have broken in and stolen, chipped away parts of that inscription, but there's part of it that's still preserved today. The breakthrough. Now, and this is a translation of what the inscription on the wall said, which is almost midway of the tunnel. Now, this is the manner of the breakthrough. While still, and then they were unable to tell what the next words were, the axe each toward his fellow, and while 3 cubits still remained to be tunneled, the voice of a man was heard calling to his fellow, for there was a fissure or crack in the rock on the right. Now when the tunnel was cut through, each of the excavators hewed through to meet his fellow, axe against axe, and the water began flowing from the source, from the reservoir, for 1,200 cubits, 100 cubits being the height of the rock above the heads of the excavators. So they were 150 feet deep in the rock. When the two excavation crews had gone toward one another, a third of a mile apart, it's a long time ago, and they were trying to meet one another in the middle. They knew that they had gone far enough that they should be meeting, but they weren't meeting. And so they were really, really discouraged about it. And then all of a sudden, in a silence, somebody said, "Listen." And they could hear the voice of someone from the other crew that was coming through a crack. And so they stopped and they redirected themselves for 3 feet, and the two tunnels met. And so you have this little offset right in the middle of that tunnel. Now here's the interesting part. Do you know when that tunnel was built? When this guy, Sennacherib, sent his chief guy, Nebuzaradan, and he stopped at the upper pool, and he said, tell Hezekiah to come see me. And among the things that he had to say to them was, why in the world would you resist me? All I've got to do to stop your water supply is put my foot right down here in this ditch, and I can stop your water supply, and I can just wait you out. You don't have any water. At that moment, guess what was happening? The tunnel was almost complete when he was saying those words. Now, is history fun? Yeah. It's informative. And also, it tells us that God's in control. Hezekiah's tunnel is still there. And the inscription has been preserved. Again, if I'm not mistaken, again, I think it's at the British Museum, but I'm not positive about that. But the portion that remains is still there and can be seen. Incredible. And it's just that one little line here in the Bible where it says, they came to Jerusalem to stop at the aqueduct of the upper pool on the road to the washerman's field. And all this time, when he's threatening what he's threatening, Hezekiah knows he's not going to be able to stop our water supply. Incredible. Our God's incredible. I hope you enjoy studying your Bible. And I also know that a little history makes it come alive. Now, I hope you'll, if you can't recall all the details of that incident, then I hope you'll make yourself a little note there to go over to Hezekiah's tunnel where it makes mention of it. Remember, that's what was happening while that was going on. It's a really, really neat deal. The Bible is a lot of fun to study. Besides giving us life, it's a lot of fun. And it's enjoyable to get together and share things together. And when you can understand, it becomes an incredible thing. It changes your life. And so I hope you'll give yourself a little, put a little energy into, for one thing, the little chart. I think it's really valuable for you. I hope you'll utilize that. If you don't have a small one, you'd like one, we'll get some more made for you. So tonight, if there's a need that you have in your life that can be met with a public response, you're not a Christian, or you need to come back to the Lord loves you. He's proved that. He's waiting for you. He's given his son to die in your place. And it's your turn while we stand and sing.